Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
Submitted for your consideration, an LSD anniversary, which will begin with a clip from a vintage drugsploitation film.
I first dropped acid when I was 18. I was over at these people's house one night. I was pretty jacked up on marijuana, so I decided to try it, and I dropped it. I don't know what I was waiting for, a flash or a rush or whatever.
What she got was a conversation with the hot dog she'd bought at the snack stand down the street.
And he started telling me that I couldn't eat him. That he had a wife and 7 kids at home to support. And I stood there with this hot dog and asked Terry, "Do you know this hot dog is talking to me?"
Far out. I mean, bummer, dude. That poor woman was probably not among those celebrating Bicycle Day on Thursday, the anniversary of what is widely considered the first acid trip by Dr. Albert Hofmann on April 19, 1943, in Basel, Switzerland. He could not have foreseen the psychedelic revolution he would inspire that day, 64 years ago, when he ingested 250 micrograms of the compound and then rode his bicycle home from the lab. Martin Lee, co-author of Acid Dreams, The Complete Social History of LSD, says that Hofmann is the antithesis of who and what we now associate with LSD.
Dr. Hofmann, who was working for Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland in Basel, was looking for a circulatory stimulant. He was investigating a series of compounds, and he accidentally absorbed a tiny bit of it through his fingertips. That was on April 16th, and he couldn't fathom how such a small amount that could have entered his system could have such profound and powerful effects. So he undertook, on what is now known as Bicycle Day, April 19th, a self-experiment in his laboratory, and he ended up having the first intentional acid trip. But he ended up being so disoriented in his laboratory, he asked to go home. So he rode on a bicycle with the help of his assistant who accompanied him. And he later recorded his experiences, wrote about them, and said that when he was riding his bicycle, he felt almost as if he was not moving at all, even though he was pedaling at a very fast pace.
Now, through the 40s and the 50s, LSD seemed to have a benign, even actively benevolent reputation. What were its supposed salubrious effects?
Well, in the late 40s and early 1950s, LSD was used by scientists to study a potential cure for schizophrenia because it was thought that if you give a normal person LSD, they would become temporarily schizophrenic. And then if they can find an antidote for LSD, maybe that would apply for real schizophrenia. This was the thinking at the time. And also, it provoked interest within the United States Army and the Central Intelligence Agency because of its powerful mind-bending effects, thinking that they could use it for their own purposes.
According to a Time magazine article in 1954, the drug would, quote, help the psychiatrist plan further treatment. Did anyone talk publicly about using it the way that, you know, we talk about Prozac today?
It was used as an aid for psychotherapy, actually fairly widely, and some famous movie stars like Cary Grant really sang its praises. This is by the late 1950s. LSD became all the rage in Hollywood, and some people claim they got more out of one LSD session than they got out of years of psychotherapy. You know, LSD really does have a kind of a Jekyll and Hyde reputation. It could induce extremely frightening and scary experiences or very beatific experiences, and it's very difficult to predict what would happen.
So were the CIA and the Army in the 1950s seeking to exploit the Jekyll part of the drug or the Hyde part?
Well, it depends which one we're saying is the bad one. But the CIA thought they had a drug that would revolutionize the intelligence trade, believe it or not, because they saw in LSD the most powerful mind-altering drug that anybody knew about at the time. It had no odor, no taste. You could use it as an interrogation aid. And what they found, the CIA and the Army, was that if the interrogator threatened to keep the subject in this crazy state forever, they would spill the beans. Now, how reliable the information would be, that's another matter. But this was found to be a very effective torture technique.
In the 60s, the drug culture began to emerge. Can you give us some major LSD cultural milestones?
Certainly music is obvious. You had the whole San Francisco sound, the acid rock from in the Bay Area in the 1960s, groups like the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane.
One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all.
But even beyond the Bay Area, you'd think of the Beatles and their album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the wonderful song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. But beyond music, LSD has had an obvious impact in the arts, in theater, think of the musical Hair, in poetry, and in this whole computer culture. In the mid-1960s, you know, many of the folks who would become the pioneers.
Are you saying that Steve Jobs was tripping his head off as a kid?
He doesn't deny his involvement with these recreational drugs. And it wasn't just him. There were dozens of people like this. You know, there's no doubt that LSD helped to precipitate the cyber revolution, if you will. And that's quite amazing when you think of the impact of that.
Do you think there's a common denominator for how all these various groups, the Army, the CIA, the counterculture, mental health patients, how they all viewed the drug?
Well, on the surface, it would seem that they had wildly divergent views. And that the CIA and the Army was trying to use LSD as a weapon, whereas people in the counterculture, people like Timothy Leary, were talking about it as a sacrament for a religious experience.
It's as though God has taken you by the hand and led you through the door of sleep, through the door of symbol, through the door of senses, into the heart of his workshop.
The common denominator is that LSD is a drug that enhances possibility. It doesn't necessarily deliver. It doesn't necessarily help a person realize those possibilities, but it's helpful to kind of peel away the sensationalism on both sides of that debate. We need kind of an intelligent, non-sensationalized discussion of what Bicycle Day is all about.
Ah, but in the 1970s, Hoffman wrote a book he titled My Problem Child.
That's certainly how he was talking about LSD, because he felt his discovery had become adopted and corrupted by so many people who were using it without a responsible attitude that he felt was important, that it should go along with it. But, you know, Dr. Hoffman, who is alive today still at 101 years of age, at his 100th birthday party, he addressed 3,000 people that came to celebrate with him at a conference in Basel, Switzerland. These were young people, you know, had dreadlocks, and some of them had 8 different colored hair, you know. And he was standing on the stage. He put his arms out to embrace the audience and says, "When I look at you," he says, "I don't think you're my problem child. I think you're my prodigy."
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martin A. Lee is the co-author of Acid Dreams, The Complete Social History of LSD.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Christopher Worth, Peter Garner, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.